The Foreign Area Officer podcast is not an official audio production. The views shared in the recordings are the personal views of the interviewee and the host. They are for informational purposes only and not necessarily those of the Department of Defense or its components. The United States Department of Defense and the United States Army make no endorsement of its content. Hello everyone, this is Michael Hill with the Foreign Area Officer podcast. Today my guest is Lieutenant Colonel Jason Morales. Jason was raised in Naranjito on the island of Puerto Rico and has been an engineer officer, special forces officer, and finally, a foreign area officer during his military career. Now serving in the Office of Defense Coordination in Mexico City, Jason served previous tours in Mexico, Colombia, El Salvador, and as an Army Interagency Fellow at the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Welcome, Jason, to the Foreign Area Officer podcast. It's great to have you and great to see you again. Why don't we start out talking about where you come from and what your background is in the Army?
Oh, awesome, Michael. Thank you for the invite. Honored to be here and be a part of this podcast. I grew up as an Army brat. My dad was in the Army for 20-something years. It was pretty interesting because he was a FAO as well. He was a Latin American FAO. Grew up in Puerto Rico for my entire youth until I graduated high school. And from there, I went to college in Florida in Embry-Riddle. And graduated with an ROTC scholarship after 4 years and commissioned as an engineer officer. And my career has been pretty non-conventional, I would say. I started off as an engineer, switched over to being a special forces officer, and then after that became a foreign area officer, which I'm doing now. So it's been a really amazing career so far. And don't regret a second of it.
So you've had three careers in there. You started out as an engineer, then SF, and then to foreign area officer. What made you want to make that double switch from engineer to SF and then SF to FAO?
Yeah, you know, never wanted to really be an engineer, to be honest with you. I wanted to be an infantryman. I was number two in my class when I graduated. I guess the Army wanted to be a little bit more diverse on how they selected folks from what I understand now, right? So they didn't want to put all number ones, number twos, number threes, number four, number fives in infantry. They want to diversify like the top 10 or so from each school. So number one in my class got infantry. I was number two in my class. So I got engineers. And then, so that's how I ended up as an engineer. To say that I truly enjoyed it, it was very different, right? With the wars kicking off and being a combat engineer and looking for IEDs for 12 hours a day in Iraq for 15 months. That was really interesting. No, again, no regrets whatsoever. Since I was young, I was very active. I always wanted to be a little bit, say, special, but I just wanted to do something different, something that was challenging, something that was going to set me apart from my peers somehow. And not to say that that's a good or bad thing, but my dad was a Ranger guy, right? So I just wanted, since I was in college, I wanted to be special operations somehow. Started off in Air Force ROTC, so I wanted to be or PJ or something else within the Air Force. That didn't pan out and transitioned over to the Army and then just focused on being an SF guy at the beginning of my career. I was very lucky because as a cadet, they ended up selecting about 5 ROTC cadets and I think 10 West Pointers to go to selection. And I was one of them out of 5 nationwide, got to go selection, ended up getting all the way through selection. And that was a wake-up call for me of I could do it. Still had to go to selection again afterwards when I was a senior lieutenant captain and try out again. But I think that was the push that I needed to go that route. And that's why I became a Green Beret. And then the FAO piece, again, following in my dad's footsteps, being able to visit my dad every summer or every other summer. My parents were divorced. I was in Puerto Rico growing up. So I would go and spend my summers with my dad in Honduras, in Panama, and in other locations. And I ended up living with them for 6 months when I was in third grade, fourth grade, and going to Panama to Gorgas Elementary School in Panama City. So that was, again, just seeing how my dad lived, the quality of life, seeing how much influence and the things that he was doing as an officer. I thought that was really interesting and something that I wanted to do later on in life. So I think I had a little bit of an advantage than most of my peers, just knowing these functional areas that were out there, mainly FAO, and knowing that was a possibility since I came into the Army.
You mentioned that you enjoyed seeing the influence that your dad had in the community. What do you remember about what he was doing?
Yeah, so just going to activities, he had a lot of activities at his house with international officers. My dad taught at WinSec once upon a time. So when I graduated airborne school as a cadet, he took me to WinSec, back then Schools of the Americas, and gave me a tour of the building. And just hearing all these stories of lifetime friends he's had around not only Latin America, but around the world. And again, just the influence he had in building those relationships and how that helped leaders within Army South or Southcom, I thought was really special. And just one little story on how things, the small community that we're in, my dad was in Honduras, 1991 to 93, around there. I went to go visit him multiple times. The ambassador of Colombia, when I was in Colombia a few years back, was the political officer in Honduras in the early 90s and worked with my dad in Honduras during that time frame. And I remember going down the reception line during the 4th of July party, and the ambassador's wife wasn't living in Colombia at the time, but she was visiting for that event. And I remember Ambassador Whitaker stopping me on the way past, saying, greeting the ambassador and his wife, and saying, Bonnie, I think her name was Bonnie. Bonnie, you remember, I bet you will remember who this is. And she was like, she couldn't remember, of course. That's 30 something years later. And he's ambassador, like, this is Mike's kid. And she's, oh my God, this is amazing. And it was just a small community, but you can see those types of relationships stay throughout. And that's something that I keep, regardless of whenever my time ends with the Army and I continue to move, have a different chapter in my life, hopefully those relationships that I've built with all these amazing folks are kept and I'm able to maintain those friendships.
That's amazing that it came full circle like that. Did you recognize him when you're going through the receiving line as well? Or did he, you said you were like third grade back then?
Yeah, I was probably like 12, 10. I don't remember back then. So I was about 8. Going to Colombia, my dad told me, hey, Ambassador Whitaker, we're friends. We still talk to each other every once in a while. Just let him know who's your old man. And I did during my initial meet and greet with the ambassador when I first got there.
Okay.
Which was one of those things that and I don't know if you want to call it little, but that relationship from my dad and the ambassador automatically gave me a little bit of WASTA. It was easier for me to get into certain conversations or certain meetings just because he already knew where I came from and he knew my dad. That helped me get into that circle of trust, if you want to call it that way.
When I was a kid, my dad served as the Navy section chief in Ecuador. And I've always had dreams of that happening. I don't remember any of the people that worked at the embassy back in Ecuador. And this is age 3 to age 6. But I have yet to meet somebody that knew my dad from Ecuador or from any of the other stuff he did over countries. That's the fact that someone he knew later on became an ambassador. That's amazing.
Yeah, no. And then again, full circle type of deal. And I know the story already somewhat. My dad's boss in Honduras, the SCO chief, when my dad was RSEC, his son ended up being my boss here in Mexico, Keith Wider. He was the RSEC and I was deputy RSEC. And then last October, we were doing the whole trick-or-treat thing for the embassy. Mm-hmm. And my dad was here and we were walking and we were talking. And Ryan tells my dad, yeah, my dad was in Honduras during that time frame. So my dad and his dad know each other as well, and we're in Honduras at the same time. Yeah, so it's, again, super small world. Now we're working together, right? And his dad wasn't a fail, but he was an Army engineer that was stationed in Honduras for a bit.
Gotcha. So
small world, small
world.
Yeah,
it is. You mentioned something I think that is really key to all of the work we do as FAOs, and that is building relationships. Whether that is with each other among FAOs, with the interagency, with the other DoD services, or with the partner nation, that's really what we're here to do. When you take away all the security cooperation, take away all the attaché work, we're here to build relationships and make it easy for us to talk to each other. How do you build relationships among the different agencies?
Yeah, so I think it's like you have this whole, what came first, the egg or the chicken or whatnot. I'm probably saying it wrong. Some people say you can't really create a leader is born, or vice versa, right? I think the same thing goes with building relationships, especially with all these different agencies and personalities. It's hard for you to think that you're going to come into an environment and be able to build relationships off the bat and meaningful relationships. Being cordial and having conversations, that's one thing, but really building that trust and building that friendship with folks from foreign service officers to partner nation to even senior leaders. I think I've gotten better with time. I've gotten way better with time. And I can tell you examples of where I failed as a young officer trying to speak with partners and having a frank conversation with my sergeant major when I was a team leader in Dominican Republic. And he came up to me and pulled me aside when I was speaking to a group of soft Dominicans and telling me, hey, you sounded more as a parent and then talking down to them instead of having a connection with them and trying to make them understand, trying to get your point across. From what he saw, they pretty much shut down when I started speaking in a certain tone, in a certain way that it wasn't the way that they're usually spoken to, right? So again, I think I learned with time on how to interact with different individuals based off of where they're coming from, based off of what they do within the embassy, et cetera. So I think it's all about just having an open mind and realizing that no matter what, it's going to take a little bit of time to understand that individual, understand that agency, that department on how they think and how they react to certain things. DOD personnel, officers and enlisted, regardless, military personnel are taught to think about a problem, come up with a solution fairly quickly, right? Foreign service officers, and I'm not trying to generalize, but most foreign service officers will take a little bit longer to analyze the problem before they give you a solution to that problem. And that's just the way they operate. And that's the way they're taught to operate. And just being able to understand that and being able to go into a meeting and say, hey, listen, let me get back to you tomorrow on how I think we might be able to achieve success in X, Y, and Z, or how we might be able to address this issue. Let me get back to you tomorrow. We're not very good at not trying to solve the issue fairly quickly. And it just takes time.
I think that's the most important point, that last point. It just takes time. You have to spend time with people. You have to be, I don't want to say in their face, because that has other connotations, but you have to be in front of them and listen to what they have to say. And I think that's it's really interesting point you make about how we as DOD try to solve things by commands and by directives, whereas folks in other agencies, they're much more bureaucratic, and we have to we don't want to necessarily adapt to the bureaucracy, but we have to work in it and through it and be able to understand that they have their limitations that they're trying to work through. And even though those might be frustrating for us, we're living in their world, that we have to make sure that we adapt ourselves to that context. I want to go back and talk a little bit about your experience as SF and that transition from being SF and going to FAO. I transitioned to FAO after 6 years being an officer, and somehow you made that work in three different careers in about the same time as I had one. What was that transition like going from SF to FAO, and how long did you spend doing special forces before you made that switch?
Yes, I hear stories about folks, regardless if you're going from a conventional unit to an unconventional unit, or going from the regular army to being a FAO. I unfortunately had leaders that were, some were amazing leaders, some not so much, but some that were just, I think leaders don't want to lose good officers at the end of the day. So they don't, commanders don't want to lose amazing subordinates that are doing good things. And I'm not saying that I was a good subordinate. I'm not saying I was a good leader, but my experience, every time I left from engineers to SF and SF to FAO, was a very ugly transition. And when I left engineers, my battalion commander did not truly agree with me leaving, or did not accept that I wanted to leave, did not accept that I would deny company commands to go SF. Wasn't really helpful as a senior leader to mentor me and to help me get to wherever I wanted to get to. It seemed that he was more worried about himself than about me as an individual and what I was going to bring to the Army regardless. And that was the case with SF as well. Leaving SF to go FAO, that transition was pretty difficult. You're leaving a community that's fairly tight as well, just like FAO, the FAO community different regions. But having a leader that wasn't frank, and I think that's one of the talking points here maybe later on about not as FAOs, I think we still struggle with being very transparent with other FAOs and just being honest about, let's say, evals, right? And saying, hey, it's not always easy getting MQs when you're overseas, right? Because you don't have a lot of FaceTime with your senior rater. And that was the same thing with my, I had a lot of FaceTime with my senior rater, but I was leaving a community. And for them, by leaving that community, they weren't going to waste the top lock, even though I might have deserved it. So it was a really ugly transition and it could have hurt me because when I was leaving SF going FAO, that was when we, the 05 year group had a 61% promotion rate, right? So from captain to major.
Yeah, I remember.
My saving grace was that when I saw my eval, I had a frank conversation with my battalion commander in SF and said, hey, if this happens, I might not get promoted. And he's a great leader. He was a great leader. And he decided to hold on to that eval until after the board met, which was my saving grace and making 04 during that time frame, right? So that transition was really difficult, was really stressful, was really frustrating for me and for my family. I was in Afghanistan. I was given 24 hours to make a decision if I was going to stay SF or go FAO. I had to call my wife, at the time my fiance, using a sat phone and having a conversation with her on what we wanted to do. And those 2 years prior of me going to Afghanistan and being in Afghanistan, I saw her. We did the math, and I think 2 months out of 2 years, and it was a week here, a few days there, right? So we, rightly, she wanted to be close to me, and we were going to get married soon after my deployment, and we wanted to be together, and we wanted to start a family. So we decided to go that route, right? And yeah. I was given 24 hours. So it was difficult.
Curious question. Where did that obligation to decide in 24 hours come from? Was that something that FAO told you or something that SF told you?
The SF. So he had to make a decision on, he had to select a headquarters commander for the group, and it was coming from our battalion. So it was between me and somebody else at WinSec right now. He ended up going and I ended up staying in Afghanistan for a little bit longer, but he had to make a decision and inform the group commander who was going to take the job, right? And I told him I wasn't 100% sure that was the job for me, and I wasn't 100% sure that I was even going to be selected to be a FAO. But I wanted to take that chance.
Right.
Right.
Okay. That's interesting. I've heard, I'm not going to drop names on this one or branches, but I had a friend in a previous job who was told and almost the same thing as you by his commander after he had been selected for FAO, where the commander said, that's great that you were selected as a FAO, but know that because you're not supporting our branch anymore, I am not going to give you an eval that you deserve, because I'm going to hang on to this for somebody that is going to stick around in our branch. And that decision by that leader caused him to be passed over for his first look to major. So that is a risk. For what it's worth, it's an unacknowledged risk in a lot of cases that we run when we make this transition, is that we might run into a situation like that where it causes us to be delayed a year in our promotion. And now we have some more tools to deal with that, with delaying the promotion cycle. And I've had two friends that have done that, where they've gone a year group back and they've delayed their promotion cycle a year to be more competitive for promotion.
Yep.
I don't know how that's going to play out. We're going to know soon on one of them, but I hope it does work out. Especially since in our career field, we really have a lot of, I don't want to say problems, but it's always something that we have to think really hard about, is where we send somebody, because most of our 05s and 06s don't have fully developed profiles. And that word, it's a loaded phrase, saying it's a fully developed profile means different things to different people. But most of our security cooperation chiefs and our SDO DATs walk into the job as 05s, 06s, and they've only rated 10 to 20 officers. For me, that seems like a pretty well-developed profile, but I had an S1 friend saying, now, your profile isn't developed until you have at least 100 ratings in it. I was like, gracious, we're never going to get that as a FAOs.
No, never. And the reality is, and I think that's, I know we're going to talk about it maybe later on, but I hinted at it on transparency and being open, and going back to the whole not having, I think we talked about this before we started recording, but talking about how HRC and how the AIM-2 cycle works and not having a true SOP on how it's supposed to work. And one of the things that they say is that you don't have to share your evals with the unit you're trying to interview for. And that's okay. But the way I approach it, I tell each individual that we're interested in interviewing is, listen, you don't have to share your evals.
Right.
However, I provide you good feedback on where you're going to stand and your chances of getting promoted and getting good paper if I don't know where you stand. And that's the problem with the FAO side of the house. I think that we're not transparent. We don't have those frank conversations with people, and it hurts individuals that should get promoted, don't get promoted because of it. And nobody was honest enough to say, you should probably go to Army South. You should probably go to Army North. You should probably go to COCOM because they have a bigger pool and a bigger profile to be able to take care of you to get promoted. Right. If the answer from that individual is, I don't care, I just want to go overseas, at least for me, I feel okay saying, hey, it's your decision to make. We want you, but you're taking that risk, right? Right. You were warned, and you know that if something happens and you don't get promoted, it was a decision that you made with your spouse or you made by yourself, and that might be a consequence of that action.
Let's unpack a little bit what you were saying about the AIM cycle. Since I came into FAO, I think we've had 4 different SOPs for how we assign FAOs. So when I first came in, it was just the standard, here's a list of assignments, which one do you want, and then FAO picks. And then they went to the TAPL, for those who remember that, the Targeted Assignment Preference List, where FAO would give you 6 choices, and then you'd pick from one of those choices where you wanted to go. And those choices that they gave you were what you needed to develop as a FAO. So that was my assignment to Chad. They gave me 6 choices and then gave me my 7th and then changed it to my 8th choice. But now we've gone to the AIM 2 cycle where it's completely competitive. And I've done 2 cycles in that one. And that has been a big change as well, because now I feel like we have a lot more control over where we go as long as we interview well and we compete well within the market. I think it's fantastic, but I know it does create some talent management problems for the FAO community.
Yeah, no, I agree, right? I think it's an amazing system. I think it's something that we should continue to explore and get better at and make the system better as we go, right? I think we're not there yet. And I think, unfortunately, people are changing the rules of the game. And there's good and bad that comes with it. And I'll start with that. The good is, like you mentioned, if you've networked, if you've built an amazing reputation for yourself, you're going to be known and people are going to want to have you a part of their team. If people know you, they're going to fight for you. They're going to want you. They're going to make it work. If you're a junior FAO just coming out of the pipeline, it's a struggle because no one knows you. You have to make sure that you make an amazing impression, and not only in your boss wherever you did IRT, but that's why it's what I tell every IRTer that comes through Mexico. Listen, every time you go to a country, it's an interview. You're interviewing with that leader, that SDODAT, with that SCO chief, with that RSEC, with whomever it is. You're interviewing for a job every single time. And if you think about it that way, it's going to help you get whatever job you want, as long as you're not competing against a person that's well-known in the field. So I think there's pros and cons to that. I think there's a lot looking at it now after this last cycle of selecting individuals. I was really happy with the way things were working, right? HRC gave the unit, gave the SCO, gave the COCOM the power to select the people they want and finding the right person for that job. Unfortunately, that's not the case now. Now there are certain restrictions that have been put on. One restriction is if you do a SCO job, you won't be able to apply for another SCO job, even if you're the best person for the job. Now, one of the things that HRC was saying is we want to give a chance to those that haven't had the chance to be in a SCO or to be an attaché or whatever it is, right? I would challenge that, saying, are we looking for the best person for the job, or are we just putting a person just because that person meets X, Y criteria that HRC has, right? So it's a little bit tricky, especially when you're talking about countries like Mexico specifically, that is a very challenging place that needs an individual that can work with a partner that is not as easy as working with partners in Colombia, not as easy with working with partners in Honduras and El Salvador. Right. Mexicans are very different on how they operate, and bringing a person that has no idea how these individuals operate and how they, going back to how you build that relationship, it takes time. And if we're not able to select the individual that we think is the best person for the job, it probably should go back to the way it used to be. Or there should be an SOP policy that gives us instructions, gives us the rules of the game. That way we can not waste our time and just say, hey, the first question that would come out of my mouth with whomever I'm interviewing or is interested in the job, are you coming from a SCO? You're coming from a SCO, sorry, you're automatically out of contention for this job, right? And yeah, going back to having those frank conversations, and I think we're not there yet. I think we're definitely not there yet on how this is supposed to work properly. And they've taken the power away somewhat from the unit. HRC's taken that power back. They can do that, but I think they'd have to be clear about it.
Maybe I'm creating a false dichotomy here, but it's almost a battle between what's best for the unit and what's best for the officer. And if we continue to favor the officer, then eventually the FAO community as a whole starts reducing its quality, because now we have two separate groups of officers, those that can or do get assignments overseas and those that can't get assignments overseas. That for me seems like why they would want to start putting in amended policies like that, is to make sure that everyone in the community has equal opportunity. Yeah.
Young FAOs have a harder time. I would say it's not fair for younger officers. What I would say for well-established FAOs that have been around for a minute,
right,
have done one or two assignments,
right?
If you look at Army North and Army South, you see a trend of officers that end up in those two components. They have been overseas, but have served more time in a component than overseas. And it's not because they didn't want to go overseas. It's probably because they might have not have done as well when they were overseas, and the word has spread that I would rather have somebody else than have that individual, right? And it's just being honest about it. You have officers that have gone from Army North to Army South, have stayed in Army North for 4 or 5 years. So you have those types of officers. And do we say we want to give them another shot at going overseas? But as FAOs, we have one or two assignments, and you're done the second assignment, you're probably going to be a SCO chief, and you're probably up for 06 sometime soon.
Right.
So that individual is going to be an SDO DAT or an ODC chief somewhere. Where's the balance? I don't know. That's the hard part. But the problem is there's nothing in writing. There's no SOP on how to interview folks, on what the timelines are, and what the rules are, right? And I think that's what we need. In order to be transparent and in order to make sure that officers understand, this is the way it's going to be.
So at what level do you think that those policies or SOPs need to be written? Is that a FAO level SOP, or is that a HQDA policy that needs to be written?
Yeah, I believe it has to be a policy that's recommended and written by HRC and HQDA approves. It has to be at that level. We have a council of colonels of 06s that come together and come up with great ideas of changing the branch, of bettering what we're doing. I think there has to be something like that that brings some senior leaders from every region together and have a conversation about what this should look like within HRC, within HQDA, on how that policy should be written.
You make really valid points. A lot of what I've seen in the past 10 years as FAO has changed their assignment cycle processes is it's ping-ponging. Every 2 or 3 years, every 4 years, however it works, the policies are changing because the requirements are changing. You probably remember back in, was it 2012, 2013, when the class of 05 and 06 and 07 had to make a lot of cuts. Then maybe it was an advantage to let people choose their assignments. But now they started to see that by letting people choose their own assignments, you started having people doing 2, 3 overseas tours in a row. And that was bad for other officers who couldn't get overseas because they were not known quantities. It's going to be interesting to see where it comes out in the next 5 or 10 years, because it might just go back to what it was originally, where HRC makes all the decisions.
I think it's very subjective to individuals. An individual might have an idea and they run with it. And that's the great thing about our military. I would say that mid-grade officers are able to make these types of recommendations,
right,
and we're able to implement. But sometimes we also have to say, hey, that sounds great. That sounds like an interesting idea, but we shouldn't be changing every 2 to 3 years on the processes on selecting folks, on assigning folks. Maybe we give this a try, a real college try, and say, let's try this for 5, 10 years. Let's modify it, improve it, and create these processes to make the system better. And if it doesn't work 10 years from now, maybe we revisit. But within 10 years, we've changed our processes 4 times on assignments. How is that possible? Why are we changing that often? I think it's very subjective to the person at the top in HRC, right? That's managing FAOs, right?
We should probably make clear, we're not talking about any individual. We're not talking about any one person, any one administration. We're just talking about how things seem to be going and some of the frustrations that we face with that. Calling out specific individuals or their policies, maybe their policies, but not the individuals.
Yeah, I would say I've always wanted to work in HRC. I really have. And I think you know this. We've talked about my ideas on how I would try to make the FAO assessment selection process better, but that's in my head. I think it would be better if they interviewed, if they narrow it down to 200 people apply, you narrow it down to 50, and then you break that down between AORs and you start interviewing those individuals and their families, right? There's legalities out there that I understand that we might not be able to do that, interview spouses and whatnot. But I would think, this is Jason speaking, that by doing something like this, you would get to see future FAOs before you select them, how they interact, how they interview, what their true thoughts are of living overseas, right, going away just from not the FAO or the officer himself, but really talking to the spouse, because we've seen it where spouses, unfortunately, might not be comfortable living overseas. And then now you have a U.S. FAO, not a real FAO, going and pursuing jobs overseas because their family is more comfortable being in the States. And that's okay. But I think that having that conversation and even explaining it to the spouse that this could be a possibility that you're going to go overseas, the very likely possibility that you're going to go overseas, I want to hear from you on how you feel about that. And this is the way it works. By not doing that, I think we take a little bit away of, you know, what type of FAOs we end up getting. And I think I've said this to you in the past, I think that the classes that we're getting now are 20 times better than my class. I think that, again, the process is working, I think, but we can get better. All that to say that we all have ideas. We all want our ideas to become realities, and that's okay. Like you said, we're not the individuals. We're talking about the grand scheme of things on how the frustrations kick in as a FAO that's been doing it for over 10 years.
And I think we're going to see a lot of changes in the next 5, 10 years, maybe certainly in 20 years, about how FAOs are used, how we're employed. And for what it's worth, I think a lot of it is going to be how our senior leaders understand the work that FAOs do. So I think things like the war in Ukraine, the conflicts that we're experiencing in other parts of the world, the possible conflict that we could have with China, or for what it's worth, with North Korea as well, FAOs are going to be at the front line of every one of those strategic events. And we train officers for this. This isn't just a random infantry officer that we sent over there to engage with country X. He's a colonel and he spent 15 years preparing to do this job. And that's why things are working. Yeah. And I don't think we do that enough as a community.
I think my background, I you see it in the sense of I've transitioned so many times from careers that you hear, especially when you're talking about straight Army conventional officers that unfortunately have never done anything joint, have never really worked with interagency. Good, bad, or the ugly, they hear these stories about what FAOs do, or they're overseas having a great time, going to parties. The whole storyline that we've heard for the last 10 plus years. I think, like you said, I think these conflicts or these strategic encounters are showing our senior leaders that we offer more. It doesn't matter how people see it, and they might look at a SCO and say, you guys are doing MTTs or training events, that's really tactical. Yeah, at the end of the day, and I've told you guys in the past, we're operational and strategic thinkers. We are providing policymakers and senior leaders, providing them information that they don't get from their folks back home, because that's why we're on the ground. That's why we're here. We're here to make sure that our leaders know exactly what's happening. And that's what we offer. And I think we've done much better these past 5, 10 years on showing what FAOs bring to the table. But we also lack, and I know conversations have happened between how good it was back in the day when it was a dual, how do you call that?
It was
back when it was dual track, you're still re-greening yourself, going back to Army units. We do lose that. And I agree a little bit in that sense. But I think it comes down to the educational piece. Teaching our FAOs that just because we work for an ambassador, just because we work for a COCOM commander, we're still in the Army. You know, our South, our North commander, they're my commander. Like, I work for them as well. Right. A lot of people forget that. It's really hard. I think the first few years I was a FAO, I was like, I don't work for Army South. I don't work for Army North, but I do. That's why I'm here. And I think we just need to make sure that we continue to push that party line to our FAOs and then also educate our senior leaders that we're here to serve them. We're here to support them. And I think Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan and you name it, those FAOs are building those relationships and getting those senior leaders to speak with these other senior leaders in these countries. There's a lot of good stuff coming out of FAOs around the world.
Absolutely. We know we need to get our name out and the importance of the work we do out to the community. I've never been in ORSA, and I probably couldn't even tell you what it stands for, but I know what they do. And I know if I ever needed somebody that has that sort of capacity, has that sort of skill set, I know that I can go to an ORSA and ask questions or request that they do some work for me. I don't feel like most officers, especially senior leaders in the Army, have an idea of what FAOs do. And I may be wrong about that. I've never worked at the Army staff. I've never worked on the Joint Staff. But most of the officers that are senior leaders, the first time they interact with a foreign area officer is if they happen to work on the Joint Staff or the Army staff and work in a regional division, or if they are a component commander or a combatant commander. I can't think of any other interaction up through being a 2-star or 3-star where they're going to have any interactions with FAOs. So I think that we have to do better at selling ourselves, but how is the question?
There's a lot of additional interactions at the senior level that we don't take advantage of. And I think you left Mexico before Capstone came to Mexico. So we had over 20 GOFOs coming to Mexico. And for me, that's one of the most important events that we host in any country, right? It's because that's where we shine, right? That's where we can show these senior leaders how we support them and what we, again, bring to the table. And I jumped up and down and said, I will be the control officer for that visit. And my relationships that I created with the two, with the senior Army FAO, with the senior Navy FAO, and even the Commandant of West Point, and you name it, I was able to create relationships with those individuals and then outside of the two senior FAOs, but also educate the Loggies, the Intel GOFOs, you name it, let them understand, like, this is what we do. And it's not like me sitting down and telling them and going down this list, this checklist of this is what a FAO does, blah, 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 right? It's me by me briefing them, by me having a sit down one-on-one discussion. Hey, this is how the Mexicans are. This is what you're going to encounter when you speak with a Mexican GO from Serena versus Samar. This is what this political environment's looking like between our administration and theirs. So not only talking Army, but talking the bigger picture, that's what we can offer our senior leaders. But between Capstone, IADC, between war college trips, you name it, there's a lot of areas that we can interact with senior leaders that have never done anything joint, have never been anything outside of conventional, but that we can still touch and influence. And I think as FAOs, that's our job, right? And we just need that.
I couldn't agree more. And there's so much more that we can do. And I think you're right that taking advantage of every opportunity. I hadn't thought about Capstone as an opportunity to sell the FAO community and the importance of the work that we do. Honestly, that's probably the best opportunity that anyone is ever going to have. I want to transition now and talk a bit about the work that you've done as a FAO. You mentioned in some prior conversations that one of the most fulfilling things that you've ever done was supporting the Hurricane Maria response. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and why that was such a pivotal moment for you in your work as a FAO.
Yeah, that was, I would say, one of the most special moments in my career. And I say that understanding that was a really horrible moment for people back home in Puerto Rico. But as an officer and a Puerto Rican officer, being able to go back home and support our Army senior leaders, like Lieutenant General Buchanan, was a very, very important part of my career so far. And so I was really lucky. I was in Mexico, my first assignment. I was in Mexico, I was deputy RSEC, and Maria hit. And right after Maria hit, an earthquake hit Mexico City. In Mexico, not only Mexico City hit, Oaxaca as well, and a few other parts of the country down south. Initially, like, it was unknown, really. Like, I didn't hear from my parents, didn't hear from my family for a few days. I was talking to our North folks back in the SCD there, of course, volunteering to help wherever needed. Because the earthquake hit, I was able to take my mind off of the hurricane and go and support several C-17s that were coming into Mexico, multiple USAR teams coming into Mexico, and some other stuff that was coming into Mexico. So I was able to be a part of that, which was, for me, really important as well. Then I get a call saying, hey, we need Spanish speakers. We need folks to go to Puerto Rico and support. Literally no plan. Like I get a heads up. Hey, get on. Here's a plane ticket. Try to get to Puerto Rico. I fly from Mexico, I think, into Atlanta, and I get there. And then, of course, all flights are still canceled because the airport is still down in Puerto Rico. So I have to find a Malair flight from somewhere. So I have to go to Charleston, South Carolina to get on an aircraft. I pretty much almost take an Uber all the way up there. They found me a flight, so I was able to fly from Atlanta.
You took an Uber from Atlanta to Charleston? That's a heck of an Uber.
Yeah, I was whatever it takes, but they were able to get me a flight, commercial flight from Atlanta to Charleston. Got to Charleston, literally got on a plane and took off to Puerto Rico. I arrived to Puerto Rico like at 2 o'clock in the morning, somewhere around there. I had been to Puerto Rico a month prior. So just arriving to Puerto Rico and seeing a darkness that I can't even explain really on an island that you can see from a satellite. If you see a satellite image of the Earth, you always see like the most lit up states and countries. Puerto Rico is one of those lit up spots on the map, right? And to land in Puerto Rico and see nothing was just super eerie. It's super just weird. So I was taken to Fort Buchanan, the military base. Literally people knew I was coming, but no one really knew what I was going to do. I was looking for work. A master sergeant was having his night duty. He's like, hey, sir, if you want to sleep on my cot. And so we hop bunked it pretty much. I slept for a few hours and got up and I started looking for work. No one really knew what to do with me. And I get a call. Someone gets a call and says, hey, have Jason come to the convention center that the general wants to talk to. So I get to the convention center in San Juan and I walk into this room, this conference room, and the general's getting briefed by all his leaders from signal to aviation, et cetera, et cetera. And the meeting ends. I sit in a corner and they call me up and he's, hey, you're going to be pretty much, he had his aide there. He had his exec, but you're going to be pretty much my cultural advisor. Then he made me his cultural advisor for pretty much 40 days. And what that meant to me was, hey, I was the one making sure that he had the general wanted meetings with the mayors, wanted meetings with the governor, wanted meetings with certain individuals. My job was to get those meetings and to plan his trips to these municipalities. So we flew pretty much every day to a different municipality in Puerto Rico. I saw more of Puerto Rico during my 40 days there than 18, 19 years growing up in Puerto Rico, right? Having the chance, again, just talking about the influence a FAO can have and having a 3-star depending on a major, making sure that number one, he had all the information he needed to be able to do his job. Number two, that he was going to these municipalities and speaking with these individuals, not just the meet and greet type of deal, but really getting the ground truth of what was needed. And I'll give you one more example or one story of how I was able to build that trust with that 3-star. And I think, this is me, he trusted me enough to listen and to pretty much adjust whatever he was doing to a certain extent if needed. And so we went to a municipality called Canoanas. And within that municipality, there was a neighborhood that was, and I say this because I can't think of the word, but like squatters, people that just found land and built homes that was in an area that wasn't permitted. But they had been there for generations, right? For this neighborhood was massive. And of course, we were working with National Guard and the Puerto Rico Guard, which I know people laugh when I say this, but Puerto Rican militia that was activated in support of Hurricane Maria. And we're delivering food and water in this neighborhood. The line is incredibly long. I start seeing that we're running out of water and we're running out of food. And I can see people noticing already. And I go straight to the general and I say, sir, we need to leave. We don't have enough supplies to give to everybody. I've already spoken with the mayor. The mayor is going to, the National Guard is going to bring more stuff, but it's going to take some time. My recommendation is to say your goodbyes and let's get out of here just in case things get bad. And the general listened. So he said, Jason, thanks. We got on the car, said he said his goodbyes to the mayor, to folks. He did the whole, spoke with different individuals, shaked hands, kissed babies, and we got in the vehicles and departed. I feel like that's what we bring, right?
Right.
We go back to being observant, understanding your environment, and being able to inform our leaders, giving them the option to say yes or no, right? At the end of the day, it's their decision. But that's my job. I felt that was my job every single day of informing him of what was happening to make sure he was making, from his standpoint, the proper decisions on how to support the relief efforts.
That is one of the unique things that we can do as 48 Bravos. Because we work for, at times, Army North, we can participate in DSCA and Defense Support to Civilian Authorities missions that you never will be able to do from another region. I might be speaking out of turn there because I'm sure Indo-PACOM can probably do something like that in Hawaii or some of the other islands that we work on. So there may be other opportunities.
Yeah.
But
and I feel like I have more humanitarian service medals than anything else. And that's not, hasn't been Puerto Rico. It's been the earthquake in Mexico. It's been hurricane that hit an island, San Andres, in Providencia in Colombia. And COVID taking Americans out of Colombia on a C-17, high-risk Americans that were stuck in Colombia with no medical support, getting them out on a C-17. I've been able to do more humanitarian assistance one way or another as a FAO than I would have ever done as an Army officer in a conventional unit or an SF, right? And I would say that those moments and those events were some of the most important and most rewarding events for me as an officer, that I was able to help people truly in need by pushing for supplies to arrive, holding an aircraft, going and seeing a runway to make sure a C-17 could land, finding LZs, you name it, we've done it. And it's been so rewarding. And I think one of the best things I've done as a FAO, and I think we do a lot of great things, but I think for me, if I'm ever going to remember and talk about anything I've done in my career, those moments are going to be the ones I mentioned before anything else. And that's before Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right. And that's one thing I learned working with you was the importance of the humanitarian effort and making sure those taxpayer dollars are going to the right places to help not only the civilian communities that need help, but also to build the relationship between us and our host nation militaries with their civilian communities. I absolutely loved being in Mexico and working on the HAT portfolio. There wasn't any job that I liked doing more than that one, because you really get to see U.S. diplomacy in action. You get to see a lot of the good that the U.S. is doing for communities in other countries. And for what it's worth, a lot of the things that we did as part of the humanitarian assistance program are only ever recognized on a local level. That's not something that's going to make national news. One of the projects we were doing in Mexico was refurbishing community rehabilitation centers. Some of those facilities had even shut down because they didn't have appropriate amounts of equipment. It was amazing to see the gratitude from those local communities and how much of an impact that our donation as the United States government was going to have on that community for years to come. So I really think that HAP is one of the biggest bang for buck programs that we have in the United States government, and definitely the DOD.
I would say that it's unfortunate sometimes, and I've seen it in other countries and I've seen it here, where HAP is somewhat the easy button in the sense of it's usually an additional duty for someone, and I'm talking about on the SCO side. It's not something that people really put any thought behind. I'm not trying to generalize here, but people look at it as we're just giving stuff away. But the return on investment when it comes to HAP, I feel brings a lot more to what we do and how we can help compared to pretty much anything else we do. And we just forget, or we just don't know. And I think it goes back to the educational piece of it's not just giving stuff away to people. It's not, you're right, how these locals look at us and how appreciative they are of what we're giving them. If it's just, like you said, just equipment, a refrigerator, a washing machine, or whatever it is, there's a lot more to it that comes into play. And I say, like, you can still do those things and you can still affect communities that's what it's meant for. Right. But your partner, your military partner at those ceremonies, putting them ahead, even though they're still going to mention the COCOM, they're still going to mention the embassy, but putting them ahead, because whenever they have access to places that they don't usually have access to, that provides us access not only to those areas, but those to those military leaders, to those regional commanders, to those zone commanders, to those unit commanders, and to the mayors and governors in those states. And you know this better than most. We have, I would say, our HAP program has built our Rolodex when it comes to mayors and governors even better than most of our Foreign Service officer colleagues, because we interact with them quite a bit throughout the year. And they usually call us or email us directly and their staffs to see how else we can help. That's the beauty of HAP. And we can get into the specifics, but really we don't have to when it comes to how fast we can move a minimal cost project event within 30 days.
Right. I think it's an incredible asset. And I really don't know how it works in other countries and what sort of resources they have. NORTHCOM and Mexico are extremely unique because of the amount of attention that Mexico receives from NORTHCOM. NORTHCOM has three countries to worry about. It's Mexico, correct, Canada, and the Bahamas. Now, NORTHCOM also deals with the Defense Support Civil Authorities, and I get that. They have a big responsibility with protection of the homeland. Nevertheless, the J-5-9 at NORTHCOM is pretty large for only having Mexico and the Bahamas. And so when you have all those resources pointed towards one country, we don't have to fight for those resources. I remember when I was in Chad, we requested, I think it ended up being around $5,000 for a HAP project of ODACA money to support COVID response. And we wanted to build and donate some beds for some of the local hospitals there in Chad. It almost felt like pulling teeth to purchase these beds locally and to get them painted and branded with the United States flag. It was really tough to get that approved. But in Mexico, it was, hey, we've got this idea. Can we do it? Sure. Put it in an oasis and it's done. And donation happens, you know, 2-3 weeks later. So Mexico does have a significant advantage over other combatant commands because we really aren't in competition. Africa has about 54 countries, which is twice as many as there are in Latin America. But you take off the Northern African countries and you're still in the low 40s. And that money has to get divided up between those 40 countries. So Mexico does have a big advantage there.
Yeah, NORAD, NORTHCOM, it's a combined command, right? So that's why Canada, they're sitting right next to us. They have the deputy commander from Canada at the command. It's just different. NORTHCOM can definitely concentrate on two countries instead of three because they just have the people, the Canadians are within the command, accomplishing things day in, day out with us, right? Where that's not the case with Bahamas and Mexico.
I want to finish up talking a little bit about how your family has adjusted to FAO life over the past years.
I've been lucky. I would say my family has adjusted really well. And it's funny that we're talking about this because I had a conversation the past 2 days about parents putting their kids into seeing a counselor or a psychologist in order to prepare for the next move because it's been difficult for their kids to adjust to a move every 2 to 3 years, right? Especially when you're going to a different country.
Right.
Those conversations have been happening these past 2 days. I would say that my wife grew up in Orlando, was born in Colombia, but was moved when she was about 8, 9 to the U.S. And then she grew up in the U.S. And I would say that's helped with this type of job. That's helped with, you know, enjoying and living an amazing life when we're overseas that we don't usually live in the States.
Right.
And having a spouse that has lived overseas before when she was growing up has been something that we've taken advantage of. And I've been lucky because of it. I was already in the pipeline when we had our first kid. So we were in El Salvador doing IRT when my wife got pregnant. And I was in grad school in Miami when our son was born. It took us 5-6 years to have a second one. And we had our daughter while we were in Colombia for 2.5 years during COVID. She's a COVID baby. I would say that just like we mentioned, kids are going to react differently. Every family's going to be a little bit different. Every country's going to be a little bit different. And I'll give an example on how Mexico can be a very difficult place for older kids, kids that are in high school going to certain schools here. We've seen multiple kids from the embassy that have gone to the American school and are in high school, and it's a very cliquish environment. It's a very different when it comes to the culture, and not just the Mexican culture, but that type of, I'm trying to think of the word, like just the privilege culture of certain Mexican kids, right. And the majority go to these schools. So we've had a lot of our embassy kids, unfortunately, that haven't adapted well. And not to say they haven't adapted well, there's been a lot of events that have caused us to pull our kids out of certain schools because of it. So those are things that, you know, as we've grown up in the FAO life, we've figured out that there's a lot of research that comes into play when it comes to going to a different country. And it's looking at schools, looking at daycares, looking at areas where you want to live. And I know you and I had a lot of back and forth on you living in Santa Fe versus Polanco, being in traffic and for over an hour each way versus being in traffic for 10 to 30 minutes, even though you say it's like 45 minutes. But those types of things matter, right? You have to really ask those questions and really go out of your way to make sure that you're making the right decisions before you even get to that country.
Right.
Going back to your question of like, my family's adapted really well. My son told me a week ago, he's like, Dad, let's go to Peru. Your next job should be Peru. I want to go to Machu Picchu. So I've had, I guess, that luxury, and I've been lucky enough to say that at least my oldest has adapted better maybe than some. And he enjoys learning about different cultures. He loves geography. He loves traveling. And he loves living overseas. They enjoy this type of lifestyle. So yeah, it's been amazing. And I'm super grateful for my family being so accommodating and so flexible and so willing to follow me around throughout Latin America with all these 1-year moves and et cetera. It hasn't been easy for them, but they've adjusted really well. And I'm grateful for that.
What have you done for your wife or your kids, or what community resources are available to them that can help make that adjustment easier?
Yeah. So starting off with the kiddos, right? There's a lot of resources for the kiddos, which we're super lucky. And I don't want to talk about where we fall under certain funding authorities and whatnot, but if you're a FMS, you fall under FMS versus O&M, right? Like you might fall under state when it comes to education versus DODIA under education, right? So there's those differences that don't really matter, but at the end of the day, matter a little bit when it comes to the processes on how DOD handles education versus DOS, right? And perfect example is the amount of benefits that we get being overseas with the type of education our kids get, right? Private education, additional helps. Like my kid is, from what ASF is saying, what the school is saying is he's a little bit below average when it comes to Spanish, right? So we're able to get that additional help from DODIA to get him tutoring covered by DODIA, by DOD education, getting that additional help to get the tutoring he needs. And we have folks that have kids in speech therapy and tutoring for mathematics, tutoring for science, you name it, there's the tutoring needed that's covered, that's not usually covered in the States unless you're paying it a pocket, right? There's a lot of help when it comes to being overseas. For the spouses, I think it's one of those things, my wife has been very proactive in finding out what type of scholarships, what type of DOD, and I'm trying to think of the word, but those types of enrollments or benefits that she can get from DOD being a spouse that lives overseas.
Right.
And her as an example, she's an ABA, she works with kids with autism and with parents with kids with autism, et cetera. And she's not able to do her hours that she needs overseas, but she's able to get certain monies or certain funding to be able to do continuous education through the university that she had her master's through to continue having her certificates and getting those extended every year, right? So she's also a massage therapist, right? While she's overseas, they automatically extend her license, but she has to renew it every year, but it's free. She doesn't have to do anything like build hours or whatever it is for those types of certifications that most spouses need. We have a lot of spouses that are doctors, that are professionals, right? So there's a lot of stuff out there you just have to look for.
Right.
The other great thing is employment within the embassies, and that varies, right? You know this, right? Being in Chad, a smaller embassy versus being in Mexico, a larger embassy in for work in that within the embassy, where it's not always going to be the case in every embassy. But it's, again, my wife leaned forward and started applying for jobs before we even got here, knowing we were going to get here within 2 months. She's already able to apply for jobs in order for her to hopefully get something before we arrived. And she was lucky the first time we got here. And because of that, she was able to get a job in Colombia fairly easy. And then coming back to Mexico, she was able to pretty much work in the same office with the same LESs that she worked with the first time we were here. The CLO, the Community Liaison Office, has a lot of really good information for spouses. The EFM, Spouses Coordinator, has a lot of really good information for spouses. There's a lot of resources out there for spouses to look into and obtain. Again, it's up to that individual on how far out he or she wants to go and how much research he or she wants to do in order to get whatever he or she needs.
Our family loved being in Mexico, but we did not take advantage of all of the opportunities that it had to offer as far as being in the embassy and being in the community. Part of that, I think, was that we lived out in Santa Fe and we were just that distance from the embassy makes a difference. My wife doesn't like to drive in heavy traffic. So I think she drove twice in the whole time we were there in Mexico, and it was just down the block to grab a donut, which is very worth it. The donuts there were pretty good. I like what you were saying about taking advantage of the opportunities for education that DoDIA offers. Our kids were homeschooled for most of the time that we were there. And at one point we asked for some support for a tutor, and the response was, did you know that DoD, if you go to tutor.com, will pay for any tutor you need in any subject that you want, whether you're in school, an adult, or a child. Mm-hmm. I don't think that most people had any idea, and I think that's available to all DoD, not just those who are stationed overseas or going to DoDIA schools. And knowing that opened a whole world of the opportunities that we could do for our kids, taking different classes, maybe take a harder class online or through the homeschool program, and then be able to have a tutor if one of the parents isn't schooled up in pre-calc or whatever it is, you can get a tutor that can help your kids work through it. And granted, it's online, but the fact that it's online means that you can keep that tutor for 5, 6, 8 years. As long as your kids are working through school, they can keep that same tutor and develop a relationship that continues over the long term, rather than going from a math tutor in Mexico to a math tutor in Colombia to a math tutor back in the States. It also made me think that it might be good to bring in, to interview sometime, some of the DoDIA coordinators that we work with and have them talk about homeschooling and finding schools and some of the policies that we work under. Because I know we did regular non-DODs, non-UD schools when we went to Brazil, but our second time overseas in Mexico, it was a completely different animal with homeschool. And sometimes it takes a while to get used to what the process is, and then also what DoD will pay for, what they won't pay for. And there were some times I'm still kicking myself about some things I didn't put down on my list of things to buy, because we really do get a very great benefit by doing homeschool, and that DoD covers almost everything. We were not able to spend all the money that DoD was willing to spend on us.
If you're not on the DoDIA distro list, I would get on it, because a few months ago, they released that DoDIA is paying for preschool,
right,
for 4-year-olds. And as soon as I received it, I shot it out to the entire team. And you could tell by all the responses how happy parents were, right, that they were going to pay for 4-year-olds going to school, which that can be a $20,000 to $30,000 bill. Right now, we're paying for our daughter, and we pay over 12 grand a year just for daycare, and that's overseas. But next year they'll be paying for that cost, which is pretty amazing for us. There's a lot of stuff out there. And just going back to your point of the community, I agree with you. It depends on where you live. You might not be as close to the embassy community, but I would say that at U.S. Embassy Mexico, it's such a massive embassy. Being in El Salvador and being a part of that embassy itself, and how the embassy was laid out with having a pool, having a soccer field, having tennis courts, having volleyball courts, having a gym, that Marine House was in the compound, the Ambassador's House was in the compound. I brought everybody together. Every Friday, you were at the cabana having a few drinks and getting to talk to folks that you haven't talked to all week, where that doesn't really happen as much. Even though the CLO here is amazing and they have activities all the time, it's just because of the traffic, because of schools, it becomes very difficult for people to stay around the embassy to interact. Every embassy is different.
True.
Every time you go to a new embassy, you're going to be like, man, I remember when I was in El Salvador, it was so different. But each embassy has their good and their bad. You just make it what you want to make out of it.
Jason, this has been a great conversation. Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about or any message you'd like to send out?
Yeah, I guess my last message or my last snippet of maybe not so useful information would be, as a FAO, our community is small. You're going to run into the same folks over and over. As you grow as a FAO officer, as a senior FAO, make sure that you mentor those young FAOs. Make sure that you make it known that your door is always open. And I know it's not the case for everybody, but in order for me to make sure that our functional area and our region continues to flourish, it's up to us to make sure it flourishes by making sure that those young FAOs know exactly what to expect, know that they have mentors out there that are going to pick up the phone, answer their emails, answer their questions, and not only with them, but also making sure that your spouses are connected. So just putting yourself out there is not always the easiest thing. And you know this, that I love entertaining. And what I mean by that, I love when IRTers come into country because I like to open up my house and just sitting out at the dining room table or at terrace or wherever and having an open conversation of life as a whole, as a FAO, as an officer, and how we can help to make sure that those officers are getting what they need and progressing in their careers. I don't know if that matters really, like if that makes any sense, but hopefully all you FAOs out there take that to heart and are able to continue to help the FAO world and our FAO officers do better and be better officers.
Bringing up the next generation and mentorship is one of the reasons that I want to bring more people in and have these conversations. The more stories we tell each other, the better we understand our job and the better we understand the people we're working with. So I really appreciate in the couple of times that we went over to your house or to Ryan's house to host those IRTers, the effort you made to really make everyone feel comfortable. And it was a safe space for everybody to talk about whatever was important to them rather than for a bunch of mid-career FAOs to make themselves feel important by telling the younger FAOs what they should do and the jobs they should have. It was always a comfortable place to be. And I think that made a difference for a lot of those FAOs that were on IRT.
Hope so.
All right, thank you. It's been great talking. It's been great catching up. I look forward to talking again and seeing you and your family next time I'm in Mexico. It might be coming up next couple months, a trip to Mexico, maybe in the next year or so, who knows, with the work that we're doing here at WinSec. But I'm really looking forward to seeing you again downrange.
You too, brother. Thanks for inviting me onto the podcast, and whatever you need, I'm here to support.
All right. Thanks. Looking forward to it.